This is part two of the book Footprints Fadeless by Mary Baker Eddy. If you want to download this book, you can go to infinity.josephmctaggart.org. Footprints Fadeless Part 2, from page 161 to the end. 176. Christian Science versus Spiritualism. It would seem like supererogation to say that I never was a spiritualist or medium and never gave a seance, but I do declare this emphatically. I did investigate this subject, but before my discovery of Christian Science, to learn its phenomena, cause and effect. As a result of this research, I abandoned the subject. About 1862, I delivered a lecture on spiritualism in the City Hall at Portland, Maine, and it was said by hundreds present to have been the most convincing argument they ever listened to against spiritualism. I never mesmerized a person to my knowledge. I'm ignorant of how it can be done, and it astounds me more than most sins to conceive of its being done. It was a common thing then if a person manifested mentally aut autre for spiritualists forthwith to declare such a one is a spiritualist or a medium controlled by spirits. Reverend Henry Ward Beecher, Theodore Parker, the poet Whittier, was said to be under spirit control. Honest thinkers say that an open, honest explanation of spiritualism as mental phenomena in no wise connected with the departed. I have accomplished more than any other person on earth, hence the shafts aimed at me on this subject. Shall the disciple murmur who drinks of the cup of his Lord, or shall the humblest follower of Christ think to escape the fiery, exalting ordeal or sin's revenge on its destroyer? The Mother Church. In 1882, we moved from Lynn to 569 Columbus Avenue, Boston. Projected. To this end, I purchased and gave to the church a lot of land on which stands the First Church of Christ, Scientist in Boston. The following letter from the directors of this church gives the facts concerning this transaction. Owing to a loss of about $4,000, contributed towards paying for the land on which the church edifice was to be erected, Mrs. Eddy, as usual, came to the rescue of her church and purchased the mortgage on the lot of land on the corner of Falmouth and Caledonia, now Norway Streets in Boston, paying therefore the sum of $4,963.50 and interest through her counsel. After the mortgage had expired and the notes given therewith became due, legal proceedings were instituted by her counsel, advertising the property in the Boston newspapers, etc., thus giving opportunity for those who had previously negotiated for the property to redeem the land by paying the amount due on the mortgage and thereby becoming owners of the land. But no one offered Mrs. Eddy the price she had paid for it, nor to take the property off her hands. So the mortgage was foreclosed and the land legally conveyed, with a clear title to Mrs. Eddy by her counsel. After the above transaction, Mrs. Eddy conveyed the lot to trustees for the purposes of having a church building erected thereon. On receiving the deed, the trustees had a plan drawn for a church building that would seat around 775 people, declaring it to be their intention to build a publishing house on the remainder of the land in connection with the church. Mrs. Eddy objected to this on the ground that such was not the intention of the deed, and through her counsel, Streeter and Walker of Concord, New Hampshire, she had the land deeded back to her and conveyed it to another board of trustees, who are to be known as the Christian Science Board of Directors. A copy of this deed is published in the church manual. To prevent all future difficulty about this church property, her counsel, Reuben E. Walker, now associate judge of the Supreme Court of New Hampshire, advised her to give a trust deed conveying a beneficiary use of the land to her church, the First Church of Christ Scientist in Boston. In order to make it safe for her church, she had derived no personal advantage from it, whatever. Neither she nor her heirs or assigns can legally mortgage, rent, remove, or sell this church building. In her deed of the church lot to the directors of this church, she retains only this privilege, namely, in case the church should use this edifice for other purposes than a house of worship, she could deed it to the other parties for the proper uses of a church of our denomination. Mrs. Eddy's transaction in redeeming the mortgage on the land gave those who had previously contributed towards purchasing the land opportunity to recover it beneficially and build a church on it. No one person contributed $7,000, or even half this sum, to the church fund for land or the church building, except Mrs. Josephine C. Otterson, deceased, of Brooklyn, New York. The balance due on the mortgage at the time it was purchased was $4,963.50, and interest only a little over $5,000 had been paid altogether before the mortgage expired and was foreclosed. After the building was completed, the church, through the Christian Science Board of Directors and their agents, presented the church edifice to Mrs. Eddy, accompanying the gift with a large gold scroll on which the presentation was engraved. Mrs. Eddy declined to receive the gift of the church edifice, any remuneration for her trouble and expense in redeeming the land, or even a salary from her church. When the church edifice was being built by her own personal effort, she raised over $40,000 and contributed it toward the building fund. We fail to see anything in this entire transaction of the Reverend Mrs. Eddy's which can be misconstrued, and we do see a benevolence that characterizes her entire life. Ira O'Knapp, William B. Johnson Clark, Joseph Armstrong, Stephen A. Chase, Treasurer. The Christian Science Board of Directors, Boston, Massachusetts, January 27th, 1902. Presentation of the church edifice, Boston, March 20, 1895. To the Reverend Mary Baker G. Eddy, our beloved teacher and leader, we are happy to announce to you the completion of the First Church of Christ Scientist in Boston. In behalf of your loving students and all contributors, wherever they may be, We hereby present this charge to you as a testimony of love and gratitude for your labors and loving sacrifice as the discoverer and founder of Christian Science and the author of his textbook Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures. We therefore respectfully extend to you the invitation to become the permanent pastor of this church in connection with the Bible and the book alluded to above, which you have already ordained as our pastor. And we most cordially invite you to be present and take charge of any services that may be held therein. We especially desire you to be present on the 24th day of March, 1895, to accept this offering with our humble benediction. Lovingly yours, Ira O. Knapp, Joseph Armstrong, William B. Johnson, Stephen A. Chase. The Christian Science Board of Directors. To this letter from the Board of Directors, I replied, Beloved directors and brethren, for your costly offering and kind call again to the pastorate of the First Church of Christ, scientist in Boston, accept my profound thanks, but permit me respectfully to decline their acceptance. While I fully appreciate your kind intentions, if it will comfort you in the least, make me your pastor emeritus nominally. Through my book, your textbook, I already speak to you each Sunday. You ask too much when asking me to accept your grand church edifice. I have more of earth now than I desire, and less of heaven, so pardon my refusal of that bequest. More effectual than the forum are our states of mind, to bless mankind. This my wish stops not with my pen. God give you grace. As our church's tall tower detains the sun, so may luminous lines from your lives linger, a legacy to our race. Mary Baker G. Eddy, March 25th, 1895. The Christian Science Board of Directors of the First Church of Christ Scientist, Falmouth and Norway Streets, Boston, Massachusetts, March 21st, 1895. Dear Mother, at a regular meeting of the Christian Science Board of Directors held this day, you are unanimously appointed Pastor Emeritus of the Mother Church. The First Church of Christ Scientist in Boston, Massachusetts, and we pray you to accept the office at our hands. The Christian Science Board of Directors, Edward P. Bates, Secretary. To the Reverend Mary Baker G. Eddy, Pleasant View, Concord, New Hampshire, the First Church of Christ Scientist in Boston has about 22,000 communicants in January 1902. While these people and a million others of this denomination reassure the public as to the faith, religion, and the life of their leader, and the officers of my church as to her business veracity, it forsooth they are satisfied. Whose business is it to complain? I exercise no power over my church apart from exacting compliance with its bylaws, which the church adopts. I decline to receive even a salary. Human deification or worship I abjure, as all know who have a true knowledge of me. The hundreds of thousands who adhere to me do so simply from love. Christian Science Publishing Society. I had given my Christian Science Journal to the National Scientist Association when, about 1891, said association, by a unanimous vote of its members, authorized the copyright of the Christian Science Journal and the property connected therewith be conveyed to me. Shortly afterwards, I caused a trustee to be executed, by which I conveyed this entire property to my church, the First Church of Christ, Scientist in Boston. Also, I selected a board of trustees that should manage the business of the Christian Science Publishing Society, specifying that all the net profits accruing from said business should be paid to my church. I retained no personal financial benefit from this property, save the free use of rooms in the Christian Science Publishing House, wherein to publish and sell my books. In making this transfer from the members of the Christian Science Publishing Society to the new board of trustees, I gave to each of the three members of the society out of my own private funds $2,000. By this transaction, I gave to the Mother Church what had legally become my personal property, a sum valued at about $50,000. Also, I paid from my private funds the entire cost of the transfer. Massachusetts Metaphysical College. This college was incorporated under the laws of Massachusetts January 31st, 1881. There was a pause in its functions during my absence and revision of Science and Health, but the charter was not surrendered, and the laws of Massachusetts have found no fault with my manner of conducting the college 21 years. My secretary's letter. In 1881, I entered the Reverend Mary Baker Eddy's class in Christian Science at Lynn, Massachusetts. I was a widower, my wife having passed away in 1872. Since then, I have never married. For 15 years previous to becoming a Christian Scientist, I was an active member of the Congregational Church. During class instruction, I boarded with Dr. Asa G. Eddy and Mrs. Eddy at their home in Lynn, and it was a happy home. In August 1882, I entered Mrs. Eddy's employ as bookkeeper and secretary at the Massachusetts Metaphysical College in Boston, and have lived in her family continuously since then. During these 20 years, I have seen her work unselfishly, educating students to fill important posts in our cause. In some few instances, her labors to help students have been met not only with their disappointments at their failures, but with their persistent envy and falsehood. Although her rebuke is strong, yet she is most tender towards all striving to do right. Her patience under wrong and injustice is proverbial. Her devout life, her moral and spiritual influence are unimpeachable, and they are strong incentives to students who come under her benign teachings. Mrs. Eddy gives herself no respite from care and declines to receive any salary for all her manifold services. Her only source of revenue is from the sales of her books and the interest accruing from her savings. As her bookkeeper, I know that she gives away annually a large sum in private charities. These gifts have in some years amounted to $80,000. She never speculates in stock, owns neither railroad, corporation, or mining stock, and has no financial interest in souvenir spoons. I have heard her say, "I might have been a millionaire, but I would never be that while so many people are poor." I name this instance of her patience. I knew a parson who served her as steward in Boston. She knew that parson was honest. He took the money from her with orders to pay the grocer and butcher monthly. After 3 months, neither on having received any payment on his bills, both made it known to Mrs. Eddy. She told them she had given the money monthly to her employee to pay them. The latter was then called to account. He said he had received the money from Mrs. Eddy, but knew not what had become of it. She then sadly recognized the cause. She saw he was the victim of mental malicious malpractice, rebuked him sternly, and pointed out the consequences of his yielding to this sin. The grocer and butcher advised Mrs. Eddy not to have too much charity. They thought it was unreasonable. She settled the matter by paying their bills, and nothing further was said on the subject. She believed that the student, left to himself, was strictly honest. He offered to refund the missing money to her, but her sympathy with his situation made her refuse it. It were needless to add the student was saved from becoming again the victim of this infernal spell. Mrs. Eddy is most conscientious in her business transactions. I have seen her often wrong herself in a business way to help another. Honesty is indelibly stamped upon every act of hers. Her unselfish, solid trust in God and her patience with sinners often astonish me. See January Journal 1899 for the account of the Christian Science souvenir spoon. More than once she has received unanimous or anonymous letters containing threats to kill her, and unimpeachable people have informed her of the attempt of mental malpractitioners to kill her. I have learned in Christian Science that it is impossible to heal the sick and to do the good that Mrs. Eddy is continually doing, and at the same time, mentally to possess the power to make folks sick or to harm them. While it can be shown that some of her accusers teach people mentally to murder folks and they themselves commit this crime, these folks are trying to make it appear that Mrs. Eddy is as wicked as they are, but they cannot. 20 years of observation have convinced me that her character can bear all the strain that can be put on it, and then remain a model for the rest of us. I sometimes have thought that her reproof and instruction were more than I could bear, but I stood it and am all the better for it. For 20 years I have kept account of the classes that Mrs. Eddy has taught. During this time, she never taught a class without having in it some members to whom she gave their tuition. Sometimes she had 16 charity students in one class. She has accepted applicants for her class without payment and rejected others offering full tuition. I never knew her to countenance sin in any form, much less to teach anyone to malpractice mentally. Something that she does not know how to teach or to practice herself, but she can perceive its effects sooner than others. I also know that no person can harm another while adhering to the theory and practice that she teaches. For many years, she did all the pioneer work for the cause of Christian Science and paid the expense thereof almost entirely from her own funds, and there was no attempt to challenge her grand life. Out of 5,000 students, the average is less than 1% of the entire number who do not love and reverence her, and a million of people thank God for giving her to the world. Signed, Calvin A. Fry, Pleasant View, Concord, New Hampshire, January 25th, 1902. This is a recording of Footprints Fadeless by Mary Baker Eddy on page 166. Marriage not prohibited. Christian Science does not prohibit marriage. It leaves this act as optional with the individual as it is in religious denomination. I never advise a person not to marry, except I see in that person or in the circumstances an existing unfitness for this relation. I leave the subject of marriage and progeny in my private teachings, just as they are found in my published works and the chapter on marriage in Science and Health, which all approve. I advise no separation between husband and wife, if by any right means it can be avoided, but recommend that they remain together. Trust God's providence and wait on it. I copy from Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, 204th edition, the following. This has been in our textbook ever since its 50th edition. Separation never should take place, and it never would if the husband and wife were genuine Christian scientists. Science inevitably lifts one's being higher in the scale of harmony and happiness. Mental malpractice. I would sooner permit a doctor infected with smallpox to attend me than to be treated mentally by a practitioner who obeys not the golden rule according to Christ's requirements. I thoroughly denounce all mental practice that is unchristian, and I had been healing and teaching in Christian Science 7 years before I knew of mental malpractice. A thief makes no haste to acknowledge stealing, nor a murderer to confess his crime. Neither does the mental malpractitioner report himself, nor expose his method. Those persons who write to editors of newspapers that Mrs. Eddy is sick, she is palsied, or she is dead, when daily I am performing laborious functions that most women would think impossible, we may suspect of being mental malpractitioners, since by these public declarations they may aim to strengthen their private endeavours. I name the above only as a fair illustration of silly fabrications. The moral and spiritual facts of being are whispered into thought through Christian Science, and thus the patient is healed by truth after the manner of prayer. Other methods, material limited to drugs or subject to evil communications, have none of the advantages of truth or Christian mental healing. For the last decade, the mental malpractice of some disloyal students, together with their public adverse declarations, have been continually aimed at me while I'm praying daily. God bless my enemies and save them from sin. Christian Science can harm no one, but it can, does help the sinner and the sick outward, onward, upwards. I never practiced or taught a student to practice contrary to the scriptures and the laws of the land. To this fact, every loyal student will testify. When first my students came to me to know how they could defend themselves and their patients against the attacks of mental malpractitioners, we knew it was wrong to attack anyone, but thought it right to defend our own lives and the lives of others. But not long thereafter, we put up the sword and anchored our trust in God to deliver us from our enemies. After the death of my husband, Dr. Eddy, I sent for one of the mental malpractitioners to come and look on his calm, dear face. The messenger, who stood at the door and delivered my request, said that on hearing it, he grew deadly pale and clutched at the door to stand. He never came. At another time, a good man whose life I had been the means of saving wrote to me that a large number of mental practitioners had appointed a day on which to unite in their mental process to kill me. On the day mentioned, I committed my way unto God, and he directed my path. Today, every loyal Christian Scientist's remedy against mental malicious attacks is to overcome evil with good, to watch, work, pray. The little that I know of the meaning of the word agamogenesis is gathered from lexicons and discredited by me as properly belonging or applied to the human species. One instance of mental aberration came to my knowledge, which I named to my students as a startling phenomenon of insanity. A young woman of good character and the patient of a Christian Scientist had the symptoms and appearance of maternity. From what she assured her healer, the latter believed in her integrity of conduct and treated her for hallucination. For she had previously shown symptoms of incipient insanity when all the symptoms of pregnancy disappeared. I have named this exception case to my students only as a new and startling phenomenon of insanity and the so-called power of a misguided belief. I believe the scripture, all things were made by him, the human, the animal, vegetable or mineral, has no propagating power. God good made all, and it was good. The late Governor Currier's letter. The late Governor Moody Currier of New Hampshire, a great and good man, highly esteemed for his executive ability as chief magistrate of the state, and a scholar, wrote as follows. He was not a Christian Scientist. Manchester, New Hampshire, August 17th, 1895. My dear Mrs. Eddy, some days since I had the pleasure of receiving by express two nice volumes containing your card, showing that I am indebted to you for the very welcome present, for which I most heartily thank you. From a hasty examination, I'm sure I will receive much satisfaction in the further perusal and study. It gives me great pleasure to find your system so free from mystical creeds and theological dogmas. Every theory of philosophy or religion, in order to stand the scientific criticism of the present day, must be founded upon the eternal laws of God. The original method of your teachings reminds me very forcibly of the characteristic manner of your lamented brother, Albert, who thoroughly despised every appearance of sham and pretense in pretended teachers of mankind. I wish to congratulate you upon the broad and independent foundation on which you are now building your great work, and trust that your fame and renown may last as long as the principles you teach. Very sincerely yours, Moody Currier. Matter of hearts. In letters to students that I was struggling to reform, I have written, you would tear my heart out and trample on it. By slight changes, such as certain reporters have made in my newspaper articles, that sentence could easily be made to read falsely. If I must wound any heart, I would prefer to have it my own rather than another's. Both my private and public life have proven this simple fact, stern and uncompromising rebuking sin. I am, but ill-tempered or revenge, I consider weak and wicked, defeating itself. People who know me will say, whether I lose temper under wrong or falsehood, I find a better way out of it. When I legally adopted Ebenezer J. Foster Eddy, MDCSD in Boston, Massachusetts. He was a bachelor, and his mother was dead, and his father married to a second wife. There is no quarrel between us. The following letter I received from him last October. In the family circle, he is known as Benny. My most blessed mother, your letter came in due time, and it was sweet and precious, just like you. And to think you took so much of your valuable time to write all of which, I appreciate and thank you for it very much. Please tell Mr. Fry the trunk came all right and thank him. I had forgotten what was in the trunk. He did not put my music in, but that does not matter very much. There is no one under the canopy of heaven that I should be so delighted to see as you, but I willingly forgo any personal pleasure if it will spare you the least in any way. Believe me when I say nothing whatsoever shall diminish the pure love and esteem I have for you, but I shall try to hold myself in readiness to come to you whenever you shall deem it best, with lots of love from your Benny. Waterbury, October 22nd, 1901. No photographs of me are extant that were not made until after I was in the 60s and later, and the negatives for the earliest of these were made in 1886. Wayside Hints. Reverend Mr. Wiggins' Wayside Hints with My Comments appeared in some of the early numbers of Christian Journal. I never preached a sermon of his or the sermon of any parson, excepting my own. At one time he gave me a subject and asked me for the explanation. I chose a text in reference thereto, wrote his inquiries on a slip of paper, and thought I placed them in my Bible. When opening to the chapter selected for Sunday service, I missed my notes and found I had failed to take them with me. However, I preached from my text. At the close of the service, Mr. Wigan extended to me his congratulations, said my explanation of the points alluded to was perfectly satisfactory. I then told him what had happened. Mr. Wigan had been a Unitarian clergyman. He was a grand man and often attended by church. For a short time, he edited the Christian Science Journal and was proofreader for some of my writings. After writing my scriptural exegesis of the spiritual and material creations without knowledge of two independent documentary accounts of creation, namely the Elohistic and the Jehovah-vistic, Mr. Wigan brought to me a pamphlet treating the subject. He said, "Did you not know of this before writing Science and Health?" I replied, "No." He was amazed at this, became interested, and afterwards read my book. The Reverend Dr. Peabody, chaplain of Harvard, and other clergymen at my request, used to preach for me in my absence. Christ, one and divine. It would seem that I had reiterated sufficiently my views in Christ to have them well known in my church tenets are these words. We acknowledge one Christ. I regard Christ as divine and myself as a human being seeking Christ. A telegram to the New York World, printed in that newspaper, February 1st, 1895, contained in substance the following. Concord, New Hampshire, February 1st, 1895. A dispatch is handed to me, calling for an interview to answer for myself. Am I the second Christ? Even the question shocked me. What I am is for God to declare in his infinite mercy. I claim nothing more than to be the discoverer and founder of Christian Science. The blessing this is to mankind, eternity enfolds. My books and teachings maintain but one conclusion and statement of the Christ, also the fable and profanity of deifying mortals. There never was, is not, and never can be but one God, one Christ, one Jesus of Nazareth. Whoever in any age expresses most of the spirit of truth and love, the divine principle of God's man, has most of the spirit of Christ, most of that mind, which was in Christ Jesus. If Christian Scientists find in my writings, teaching, and example a great degree of this spirit, they can justly declare it. But to think or speak of me as the Christ, they do not. And it were sacrilegious, savoring more of heathenism than of my doctrine. Signed, Mary Baker G. Eddy. In one article in the Boston Journal, April 11th, 1899, I wrote, "All Christian Scientists deeply recognize the oneness of Jesus, that he stands alone in word and deed. The visible demonstrator and great teacher of Christianity, whose sandals none may unloose." I state my doctrines fairly, however abstract they may appear. That science and health, with key to the scriptures, was inspired seems plain to me, since I could have had no human motive for writing what was not attractive, what must cause me enemies, to leave a peaceful home, friends, and to give up my standing in society for the toil, privation, and dishonor of a reformer. Jesus, our great way shower, was maligned and persecuted, but he had shown the way, and it is the victory over sin, disease, and death. It is the disappearing of the fleshly personality and the reappearing of spiritual existence. When his demonstration is understood in Christian Science, all mankind will follow Jesus' way, and rising above sin, disease, and death will put off the flesh and the error thereof, and put on the real man in the image of his Maker, even the spiritual man in Christ. This in no losing, but gaining man's eternal identity and individuality. We're reading Footprints Fadeless, and we are on page 171. Reverend I.C. Tomlinson's letter. I present herewith a letter from a citizen of Concord, the Reverend Irving C. Tomlinson. Our board of lectureship is inclined to be, and is instructed to be, charitable towards all, hating none. The purpose of its members is to subserve the interest of mankind and to cement the bonds of Christian brotherhood, whose every link leads upward in the chain of being. The cardinal points of Christian Science cannot be lost sight of, namely one God, supreme, infinite, and one Christ Jesus. I deem it a privilege as a fellow townsman and friend of the Reverend Mary Baker G. Eddy to refer to the high esteem in which she is held by the leading citizens of the capital city of the Granite State. Her birthplace adjoins our municipality. Her youth was spent in a neighboring community, and during the past 12 years, she has resided in this city. There are people in Concord who knew her in childhood. Others were her friends in youth, and not a few of our distinguished citizens have seen her more or less frequently in the past 12 years. All these people respect the honesty, integrity, and uprightness of the illustrious citizen, neighbor, and friend. She comes from an old and honored family of this commonwealth, zealous in good works and famed for their exalted Christian character. Those in our midst who have followed her distinguished career gladly certify that she has proved worthy of her noble ancestry. Mrs. Eddy purchased and fitted up Christian Science Hall in Concord at a cost of $26,000. Because the local Christian Scientists had no suitable place in which to hold their services, and because winter was rapidly approaching, Mrs. Eddy, to hasten the enterprise, requested the builder to ask his employees if they felt so disposed to work upon Thanksgiving Day. The workmen accommodated her, and as a token of appreciation, she presented to each a $5 gold piece in addition to their daily wages. The urgency for haste in the completion of the structure did not prevent her exhibition of Christian kindness. At one of the busiest moments, she requested the superintendent to suspend the noise of building, lest it disturb the weekday conference of her neighbour, the Baptist Church. Mrs. Eddy often refers to the children's courtesy to her in the street, and her pleasure from it. She has given to our little church in Concord the sum of $100,000 for the erection of a handsome granite edifice. Our people well know her readiness to aid the high purpose and the honest endeavours of others. Whether or not they be of her household of faith, the poor of our city do not forget that through her love of children, 200 pairs of shoes protect as many pairs of little feet from the winter's ice and snow. By special invitation of the officers of the New Hampshire State Fair Association, Mrs. Eddy visited their beautiful grounds in Concord on Governor's Day, 1901. She was received at the entrance by representatives of the association and under official escort conducted to a place of honour in front of the crowded grandstand, where were seated the governor and invited guests. A reception committee consisting of the executive board of the Fair Association surrounded her carriage and stood with uncovered heads, while Mr. Moses, editor of the Concord Daily Monitor, in their behalf delivered an eloquent address of welcome. The spontaneous reception reveals the patent fact that in her home city, she's not only the esteemed leader of a great religious denomination, but honored by our best people, regardless of class or creed. Signed, Reverend Irving C. Tomlinson, Concord, New Hampshire, January the 28th, 1902. Closing words. Beloved brethren, let us remember that an unwise word or deed of ours is a shovel full of earth thrown upon the grave to which the enemies of Christ would consign Christian Science. While the rapid growth and steadfast prosperity of our denomination in the midst of persecution is God's benediction on our Christianity. Dear reader, I could introduce you to my witness across the sea, to Earl and Countess, Marquis and Marchioness, Lord and Lady, and in my native land, to the best people in it, distinguished professors, poets and authors, doctors of divinity and doctors of medicine, and in my native state, to New Hampshire's noblest sons and daughters, and to my attorney, General Frank S. Streeter. Also, I could modestly call your attention to my church, with, I believe, the largest number of communicants of any one church in the world, and to over a million Christian Scientists who entertain the higher hope and live the higher life to bear testimony of me. But I chose for my witness the weak things of this world to confound the mighty, and call your attention to my best witness, my babe, the newborn of truth, science and health, with key to the scriptures, that will forever testify of itself and its mother. Additional note, the occasion for Mrs. Eddy's letter to General Butler was a long demarche which he made to the Secretary of War on the subject of slaves within the Northern Army's lines. She was sufficiently impressed with his stand and her own correspondence with him to refer to this in an essay entitled The War, which she wrote years later, just about the time that the Boston Herald was asking her for her comments on the Spanish-American conflict over Cuba. CMY 277. The text of the essay is as follows. The war. Pending the action between two nations, one in a state of semi-barbarism, the other in that of the most advanced civilization of any nation on earth, hangs the discussion, war or no war. On the second year after the Civil War was waged between North and South in the United States, I addressed a letter to General B.F. Butler, begging him, in behalf of God's behests to our nation, of its people and the women in New Hampshire, to take a firm step toward liberating the slaves in our land as a sure protest for stopping the war, its devastation, demoralization, and bloodshed. Through his aide-de-camp, he replied complimentarily and encouragingly. The measures he adopted were accomplished, the end proposed, and the war terminated. Now is another issue before our nation, and I again foresee that the injustice and oppression of class legislation in the United States, if allowed, will ultimate in another moral law broken, and another divine demand to free the oppressed, and the law of God will not abate one jot of this demand till it be obeyed. And the divine love that leads impersonally will not spare the rod, that rod that blesses a nation and the people while it breaks the will of nations, whose codes or creeds withhold by any means human rights. The rights of conscience, of self-government, of freedom to serve God and to bless mankind in the manner that accords with divine law, and by its fruits is proven to sustain this relation to eternal justice. When an evil of such vast proportions as unjust legislation is permitted to govern in our midst, then we know that in the sentiment of our great Jefferson, we should tremble for prosperity and expect the reward of iniquity to follow in obedience to inevitable, irresistible right. We as a people have a right under the laws of our nation to worship God according to the demand of Christ, heal the sick, cast out evils, and according to the demands of our own conscience, disciplined and elevated, to worship God as divine love, not a partial tyrant force, ordaining a few of the creatures of his creating to escape from his wrath and find salvation, while others may not, cannot, however much they strive to do it, or even are not permitted by his irrevocable decree to struggle for salvation. Today, the persecutive arm of the church and the medical law would have a God that foreordains man to sin, to be sick, diseased, and to die. Otherwise, he is not their God. And we shall have none other than theirs. Our forefathers purchased through their blood the life of this nation. Shall it be bartered for a false religion or a proscriptive inane system of medicine? The old dose of poison, the lance to spill one's blood and the lice to be eaten, have partly succumbed to the civilization of homeopathy. But has the spirit of bloodshed and brutal media obscenes kept pace with the acting before footlights? or is it a mere masquerade of civilization? If this is thus, then God will turn his lens on the hour, and mind will remand till the spirit of justice and mercy come forth, and the mask drops, and the brow of manhood and womanhood is seen clean and high above the animal by reasons outside of ignorance or vice. General Butler's letter to Secretary Cameron was recorded in the press at the time as follows. Headquarters, Department of Virginia, Fortress Monroe, July 30th, 1861, Honorable Simon Cameron, Secretary of War. Sir, by an order received on the morning of the 26th of July from Major General Dix, by a telegraphic order from Lieutenant General Scott, I was commanded to forward of the troops of this department 4 regiments and a half, including Colonel Baker's California Regiment, to Washington via Baltimore. This order reached me at 2 o'clock a.m. by special boat from Baltimore. Believing that it emanated because of some pressing exigency for the defense of Washington, I issued my orders before daybreak for the embarkation of the troops, sending those who were among the very best regiments I had. In the course of the following day, they were all embarked for Baltimore, with the exception of 400, for whom I had not transportation, although I had all the transport force in the hands of the quartermaster here to aid the bay line of steamers, which, by the order from the Lieutenant General, was directed to furnish transportation. Up to and at the time of the order, I had been preparing for an advance movement by which I hoped to cripple the resources of the enemy at Yorktown, and especially by seizing a large quantity of Negroes who were being pressed into their service in building the entrenchments there. I had 5 days previously been enabled to mount for the first time the first company of light artillery, which I had been empowered to raise, and they had but a single rifled cannon, an iron 6-pounder. Of course, everything must and did yield to the supposed exigency and the orders. This ordering away the troops from this department, while it weakened the spots at Newport News, necessitated the withdrawal of the troops from Hampton, where I was throwing up entrenched works to enable me to hold the town with a small force, while I had advanced up the York or James River. In the village of Hampton, there were a large number of Negroes, composed in a great measure of women and children of the men, who had fled thither within my lines for protection, who had escaped from marauding parties of the rebels, who had been gathering up able-bodied blacks to help them in constructing their batteries on the James and York rivers. I had employed the men in Hampton in throwing up entrenchments, and they were working zealously and efficiently at that duty, saving our soldiers from that labour under the gleam of the midday sun. The women were earning substantially their own subsistence in washing, marketing, and taking care of the clothes of the soldiers, and rations were being served out to the men who worked for the support of the children. But by the evacuation of Hampton, rendered necessary by the withdrawal of troops, leaving me scarcely 5,000 men outside the fort, including the force at Newport News, all these black people were obliged to break up their homes in Hampton, fleeing across the creek within my lines for protection and support. Indeed, it was a most distressing sight to see these poor creatures, who had trusted to the protection of the arms of the United States, and who aided the troops of the United States in their enterprise, to be thus obliged to flee from their homes, and the homes of their masters, who had deserted them and become now fugitives from fear of the return of the rebel soldiery, who had threatened to shoot the man who had wrought for us, and to carry off the women who had served us, to a worse than Egyptian bondage. I have therefore now within the peninsula, this side of Hampton Creek, 900 Negroes, 300 of whom are able-bodied men, 30 of whom are men substantially past hard labor, 175 women, 225 children under the age of 2 years, and 170 between 10 and 18 years, and many more coming in. The question which this state of facts presents are very embarrassing. First, what shall be done with them? And second, what is their state and condition? Upon these questions, I desire the instruction of the department. The first question, however, may perhaps be answered by considering the last. Are these men, women, and children slaves? Are they free? Is their condition that of men, women, and children, or of property, or is it a mixed relation? What their status was under the Constitution and laws, we all know. What has been the effect of rebellion and the state of war upon that status? When I adopted the theory of treating the able-bodied Negro fit to work in the trenches as property liable to be used in aid of rebellion, and so contraband of war, that condition of things was in so far met, and I then and still believe, on a legal and constitutional basis. But now a new series of questions arises, passing by women. The children certainly cannot be treated on that basis. If property, they must be considered the encumbrance rather than the auxiliary of an army. And of course, in no possible legal relation, could be treated as contraband. Are they property? If they were so, they have been left by their masters and owners, deserted, thrown away, abandoned like the wrecked vessels upon the ocean. Their former possessors and owners have carefully, traitorously, rebelliously, and to carry out the figure practically, abandoned them, to be swallowed up by the winter storm of starvation. If property, do they not become the property of the salvers? But we, their salvers, do not need and will not hold such property and will assume no such ownership. Has not therefore all proprietary relations ceased? Have they not become thereupon men, women, and children, no longer under ownership of any kind, the fearful relics of fugitive masters? Have they not, by their master's acts and the state of war, assumed the condition, which we hold to be the normal one, of those made in God's image? Is not every constitutional, legal, and moral requirement as well to the runaway master as their relinquished slaves thus answered? I confess that my own mind is compelled by this reasoning to look upon them as men and women. If not freeborn, yet free, manumitted, sent forth from the hand that held them, never to be reclaimed. Of course, if this reasoning, thus imperfectly set forth, is correct, my duty as a humane man is very plain. I should take the same care of these men, women, and children, houseless, homeless, and unprovided for, as I would of the same number of men, women, and children, who for their attachment to the Union have been driven or allowed to flee from the Confederate States. I should have no doubt on this question, had I not seen it stated that an order had been issued by General McDowell in his department, substantially forbidding all fugitive slaves from coming within his lines or being harbored there. Is that order to be enforced in all military departments? If so, who are to be considered fugitive slaves. Is a slave to be considered fugitive whose master runs away and leaves him? Is it forbidden to the troops to aid or harbor within their lines the Negro children who are found therein? Or is the soldier, when his march is destroyed, the means of subsistence to allow them to starve because he has driven off the rebel master? Now, shall the commander of regiment or battalion sit in judgment upon the question whether any given black man has fled from his master or his master fled from him? Indeed, how are the freeborn to be distinguished? Is one any more or less a fugitive slave because he's labored under the rebel entrenchments? If he has so labored, if I understand it, he is to be harbored, by the reception of which are the rebels most to be distressed, by taking those who have wrought all their rebel masters desired, masked the battery of those who have refused to labor and left the battery unmasked? I have very decided opinions upon the subject of this order. It does not become me to criticize it, and I write in no spirit of criticism, but simply to explain the full difficulties that surround the enforcing it. If the enforcement of that order becomes the policy of the government, I, as a soldier, shall be bound to enforce it steadfastly, if not cheerfully. But if left to my own discretion, as you may have gathered from my reasoning, I should take a widely different course from that which it indicates. In a loyal state, I would put down a servile insurrection. In a state of rebellion, I would confiscate that which was used to oppose my arms, and take all that property which constituted the wealth of that state, and furnish the means by which the war is prosecuted. Beside being the cause of the war, and if in so doing, it should be objected that human beings were brought to the free enjoyment of their life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, such objection ought not to require much consideration. Pardon me for addressing the Secretary of War directly upon this question, as it involves some political considerations, as well as propriety of military action. I am, sir, your obedient servant, Benjamin F. Butler. Reference was also made in Footprints Fadeless to Professor Sheldon's compliment to Mrs. Eddy for her address on North and South in 1863. The professor's article read, "The North and the South." We had the pleasure on Tuesday evening of hearing Mrs. Patterson's lecture on the above subject. We understand Mrs. P. has lived in the sunny South some 30 years, and is therefore able to speak from the best authority, personal experience. It was much to be regretted that the audience was very small, arising from no want of appreciation of a first-class lecture, for the public could not judge of its merits, not having heard it. The citizens of Waterville have given a crowded house to a lecture with not a tithe of the excellence of this. She gave a general view of the character and spirit of the rebel leaders as regards their long-cherished purpose to dissolve the Union and establish a nationality under which their lust for dominion should be gratified, cited instances of the barbarous working of the slave system, described the enfeebled resources of the South as compared with the gigantic powers of the North, only the surplus of which has yet been set forth and closed with a solemn and eloquent appeal to all Union-loving men and women to sustain our brave and already victorious soldiers in giving a death blow to the rebellion. She left not a peg for the Chicago democracy to hang a hope on. These and other kindred points were presented with a sharpness, and of logic and a beauty, purity and force of language, rare in the most finished orators. While in her composition and manner, she combined the delicate tenderness of the female heart with the broad strokes of the masculine hand, she seemed to lack that compass of voice which is essential to give completeness of effect to her beautiful words and patriotic thoughts. Her testimony adds largely to the weight with which history is rife that slavery is hostile to the prosperity and life of all Republican institutions. This is the end of Footprints Fadeless by Mary Baker Eddy.